The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. No one could quite figure out how we could transact digitally peer-to-peer without a middleman. Welcome, everyone, to the Coin Bureau podcast. My name is Guy, and this is my friend
Mad Mike Mooch,
joined as ever by my good and old friend Mad Mike Mooch. It's great to be here again with you, Mad Mike.
How are you, man?
I'm well, thanks. I'm well.
What's new?
Well, not an awful lot since we last spoke. It's been nose to the grindstone. It really has. Been very, very busy. In a good way.
Where are we today?
Today, as a special surprise for you, we are going to be recording from the home dressing room at Stamford Bridge.
Amazing.
Which is, of course, the home of your beloved Chelsea Football Club.
Yes.
Yeah. I have managed to pull some strings, and I have managed to get us privileged access to the first team dressing room, to the inner sanctum of...
of Stamford Bridge.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, here we are. And I can say one thing. I have never seen quite so much marble in all my life. This must be a special moment for you to be in.
It's
this.
Been a while since I've been here.
Yeah.
Anyway, should we talk about some crypto stuff?
If you like.
Or are we not talking about crypto again?
No, no.
This crypto podcast.
The crypto podcast that doesn't actually talk about crypto. I know, yeah. The last couple of episodes, we haven't really got onto cryptocurrency at all, have we? Because we've been talking about everything underlying it, the banking system, how it works, how money moves around, all these sorts of things. So yes, rather embarrassingly, we haven't got to crypto at all. But, Mike, I can promise you today, we are going to talk about crypto today.
Sure.
We're not going to talk about it a lot. Because what we're actually going to be talking about today, really, is the technology that underpins crypto, that makes crypto possible. And that, my dear old friend, is blockchain.
Blockchain.
Blockchain. The very same. So, yeah, and I think this is almost certainly going to be a two-parter, at least, because blockchain, I have to say, gets pretty complicated.
Big old subject.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot to dig into. There are a lot of very complicated ideas and bits of terminology to explain and to look at. So, yeah, I want to give us the luxury of being able to kind of sit in it for a bit. Rather than try and race through and define that and define this and explain what hashing is very quickly and all these sorts of things, I'd like to be able to spend a little bit of time on it so both you and me and the listeners can kind of feel comfortable with it in the end. I don't want it to become something that's
overbearing and just too much too quick.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we're going to have a very nice, leisurely and, of course, informative discussion about blockchain technology, which, as I say, is the reason why cryptocurrencies are able to function. I should say as well that we will, when I talk about examples of blockchain, what I will almost certainly be referring to is Bitcoin, because Bitcoin obviously is the original cryptocurrency.
OG.
The OG, exactly. So when I use examples, we will generally use Bitcoin. Let's kick off then. Let's do a quick recap from last time, just so as we know where we are and we can kind of pick up the thread of our discussion then. So you might remember we talked about how money moves around.
Digital money, yeah.
Exactly. I think it's good, again, to just highlight the difference between digital money and good old cold hard cash.
Cash.
Yeah. Because obviously, as you'll remember, the problem with cash is that you can only transact face-to-face.
Face-to-face or just use a postal. We've gone through this in the last one, but yeah, tricky.
Or as you pointed out, a giant catapult.
Cash catapult.
The cash catapult.
Yeah.
Yes, we talked about digital money and all the things, all the stuff going on behind the scenes when we try to move our digital money around, when we make payments, when we make bank transfers, all those sorts of things. There is a heck of a lot happening behind the scenes. It's not as simple as pounds or dollars or any other currencies kind of flying through the ether. What we also talked about was the need for third parties in transactions, in these digital transactions. Someone in the middle to process the payment, to keep the records up to date. And that could be a bank, that could be a payment network, it could be a card issuer, any of these sorts of things. There's always someone, at least one other party in the middle, making it happen, making it possible. And we talked about the unbanked as well and how there were well over a billion people across the world who didn't have access to any of the sort of banking facilities that we here in the developed world take for granted, and how that shuts them out of the economy and basically keeps poor people poor, which is, again, a big thing in crypto. And as I said, we come across this phrase, bank the unbanked, quite often. And finally, the other thing that I want to pick up from last week and run with is we talked about the double spend problem.
Yeah.
When it comes to digital money. Do you remember this?
Yeah. It's called just the duplication of it and sort of that, making sure you're not getting charged twice.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. So the problem with digital assets is that they're very easy to copy. They're very easy to replicate. So if I'm paying you with digital money, you have to be confident that I'm not basically sending the same digital file to someone else. So again, this is where third parties come in, because they have to stand in the middle. Yeah, they have to make sure that double spending isn't taking place. They are responsible for keeping the records up to date and keeping us all basically honest. Because we can't really trust each other, can we?
No.
No. The double spend problem. Let's have a look at this. So the double spend problem, as I said, is traditionally solved by having the third parties in the middle. They keep the database of transactions and everyone's balances up to date. That role is generally fulfilled by banks. But as I think, again, we touched on last time, third parties are kind of problematic.
Yeah.
Because having someone in the middle of these things, they can see what we're spending our money on. They can also lock us out of their accounts if there's something that they don't like the look of. And I think you used the example last time of WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is something I remembered that when I was putting the notes together for this show, and I went back and had a look. So that was back in 2010. So basically, back in 2010, PayPal was processing donations to WikiLeaks, and the US government basically lent...
Strong on them.
Yeah, exactly. They lent on PayPal and said, you might want to consider not doing this. And so PayPal had to suspend payments to WikiLeaks. Now, there was quite a big outcry about this, and I mean, I'm loath to express any sort of sympathy for a big multinational organization like PayPal, but I mean, I can imagine that they were put in a kind of difficult position because on the one hand, they have this duty to their customer, in this case, WikiLeaks. But on the other hand, they have the US government breathing down their neck. And I don't think anyone
wants to be on the wrong side of them.
Exactly. So as a result, WikiLeaks was deprived of funding. And which is why, of course, WikiLeaks then turned to soliciting donations in crypto. In Bitcoin,
yeah,
which is something again that we'll touch on later. So we're left with this dilemma. If we want to transact peer to peer but digitally and without a third party involved, then we need a system that can get rid of this double spend problem. We need to because there's no way that we can all trust each other to stay honest. We need a system that kind of keeps us honest. Do you see?
Yeah.
For years, this was basically the major barrier that prevented a fully functional digital cash, a peer-to-peer money. This was what prevented that sort of system from coming into play, because no one could quite figure out how we could transact digitally peer-to-peer without a middleman, without a kind of centralized authority. Before we look at the solution to the double spend problem, but one that doesn't involve a third party, let's quickly talk about centralized databases.
Okay.
Because that is what these third parties use to keep all our records up to date.
Sure.
Okay. So obviously everyone all over the world is transacting on a daily basis, and that is creating enormous quantities of data. And in recent years, the amount of data that we create, not just from transacting, but from everything, from using the internet, from using all these interlinked devices, the amount of data that we create is phenomenally huge. And because data storage has got cheaper, it's almost not worth anyone's while actually deleting this data. It's cheaper just to store it. But it still does need to be stored. And when we're talking about payment networks, when we're talking about keeping people's accounts up to date, keeping track of people's spending and borrowing and all these other financial transactions, all these records need to be stored. And they need to be kept on these huge databases, which then have to be maintained, constantly updated, and crucially protected. Because what these databases tend to act as is giant honeypots.
Okay.
These got these honeypots of data. And for thieves, that is really, really tempting.
Yeah.
Because can you imagine if someone was able to gain access to all this data, to all your personal data? These giant troves of data, these giant honeypots, any hacker that manages to get access to them can then make a lot of money selling them on to criminals and scammers and all that sort of lot. And we hear about these data breaches all the time. And two of the most notorious, perhaps, not necessarily the biggest, but the most notorious. Do you remember Ashley Madison?
Yes. Yeah, Ashley Madison, which is the website designed for cheating partners.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Your Little Bit on the Side or something or like yeah. that? It was kind of like that has some very sensitive information which could ruin some lives, marriages, and families.
Which it did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was back in 2015. Ashley Madison got hacked. All these people's personal data got stolen. And then the hackers basically said they were going to release it, didn't they?
Mm.
And they did release it, and it caused an absolute tidal wave of trouble.
Yeah.
Which you can understand, really, can't you? You can imagine that a lot of people would have been pretty devastated, either to find their details had been leaked, or to find that their spouse, their other half, the person that they trusted, was actually on this website that was specifically designed for people who wanted to have extramarital affairs.
Yeah.
So this was one of the problems with keeping all this very, very sensitive data all in one place. It made it a target for hackers, and when they managed to get in, they were able to cause chaos. A couple of years later, in September 2017, Equifax was one of the three largest consumer credit reporting agencies in the United States. So again, lots of sensitive information breached the sensitive and personal data of 148 million Americans.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought it was only 350 million Americans, or 360.
I couldn't tell you the exact population of America.
Probably a third of America.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was one of the three largest consumer credit reporting agencies in the United States.
Yeah.
So perhaps it could be expected to have about a third of people on. Anyhow, it was a disaster for all involved. But these data breaches are all too common. Here's a list of some companies that have suffered data breaches, some of them more than once. Yahoo, I think, has been breached a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn.
Yep.
Facebook.
Yep.
eBay.
Yep.
Then we've got Capital One.
Yep.
And First American Financial Corp. Now, I hadn't heard of First American Financial Corp. I had to look at the FAFC. They were breached. And obviously, Capital One and First American Financial Corp, as their name suggests, held, again, a lot of personal financial information. Mm. And they've all suffered data breaches in the past, in recent years. So what this tells us is that the third-party solution to the double spending problem has another weakness. Not only is there someone with oversight over our spending who themselves are vulnerable to interference from governments and regulators, but we also have to trust these third parties to keep our data secure. We have to hope, really, that they
got their act together.
Yeah, they got their act together.
You have to do due diligence for everything you have to every time you pay for something online.
Well, in theory, yeah, but in practice, that would be impossible.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. It's just there's only so much investigating you can do before you buy a coffee.
Yeah.
or order something online.
Everyone, one queue of people waiting to pay, and another queue of people
just researchers
just
going.
Researching.
Okay, what is their cybersecurity?
Yeah.
Protocol.
Is this coffee shop going to lose my data? Do they have a history? Who are their payment providers?
Yes.
Yeah. So they can't always do it. We have to trust them, and sometimes that trust is breached, unfortunately. We have two big problems with our current payment system. It's controlled by big banks and corporations who can see what we're doing. They're subject to oversight themselves, and it also requires these enormous centralized ledgers full of data, and those are a magnet for hackers, and they have to be kept safe. And as you can imagine, cybersecurity is big business.
Yeah.
It costs an absolute fortune. And spending on cybersecurity by companies, by these big data companies, is massive. It runs into the billions every year.
I've seen The Matrix. I know how this works.
Yeah. The Holy Grail, therefore, what we're looking for is a system that allows us to transact with one another at a distance, to transact digitally, but that doesn't need a third party to keep everyone honest, and that ideally doesn't result in a huge pile of vulnerable data sitting around in one place that can be easily
accessed.
So that is what we're after, and we'll find it after the break.
Okay.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
We're looking for this holy grail of a system that we can transact with one another, but we don't have to be in the same room. We don't have to have a third party in the middle keeping watch over everyone. And we don't want loads of our data lying around.
Mm.
So the solution to this is, funnily enough, blockchain. Now, I imagine your first question is,
what is blockchain?
Exactly.
It's kind of what everyone thinks, because you kind of, not everyone, but ignoramuses like myself and people who are maybe headstrong with their investments. They just see some green candles.
You just see a chance to make money. Oh, there's a blockchain behind this. Fascinating.
I mean, it's like if you invest in stocks, you don't have an inside knowledge of everything you're investing in.
Well, yes and no.
You don't know exactly what's going on.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of investors out there.
Yeah, but not me. And not the majority. So like if you're investing in a pharmaceutical company, you don't have any idea about everything that they're doing. Do you know what I mean?
I suppose you can't know every single drug that they're making.
No.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, well, it's a great question, because that is the question that I want to answer. What exactly is a blockchain? This word's come up several times. We haven't answered it yet. So I'm going to give you a very simple kind of working definition of a blockchain. I'm going to try and keep it as jargon-free as possible. Because I think when you start getting some of the jargon that you find in this area, it can get really quite confusing. So if I do use bits of jargon, then I will try and explain them as I go along.
Thank you.
Does that sound fair?
Fair enough.
Do we have a deal?
Yeah.
Okay. A blockchain is basically a database made up of transactional data that's stored on a network of separate computers. These computers that store blockchain data, that store this ledger, are known as nodes. Okay?
Yeah.
So this is a term we'll hear a lot, but the nodes on a blockchain are basically the computers that are running the particular software for that blockchain, that are a part of that network. These nodes can be scattered across any number of locations. And the whole point is that they are supposed to be in many different places. So the more the better, in fact. The more nodes there are and the more scattered they are, ideally across the world, the better. Because each node stores a copy of the entire transaction history. And this can be referred back to in case there are any disputes. So think of a node on a blockchain. Basically, a computer that's downloaded is running the software for that particular blockchain, and each individual node is acting like an individual bookkeeper. So it's keeping a copy of the ledger. Okay? So we can already see that if they're all spread out, then this idea of centralization, this idea of all the information being kept in one place, is already being addressed, because a blockchain is a decentralized network. And the transaction history it holds is often referred to as a distributed ledger. So, yeah, this is something that another term that comes up a lot, distributed ledger. This is essentially what a blockchain is, a record of accounts spread out over many interlinked computers. Okay, so here is how it works. And again, this, I'm going to keep this super simple. We'll touch on some terms and some concepts, but I think most of those we're going to come back to later, maybe in a later episode, just so as we can get a sort of very simplified definition of how a blockchain works from this point. So, and again, I should state, if I use examples here, it's going to be Bitcoin. Again, because as you say, Bitcoin is the OG, the OG cryptocurrency. Okay, so let's imagine a transaction takes place. Now, last time I was sending all these £10 notes to you, through the traditional banking system. The tables have been turned. Mikey, you are going to send me a Bitcoin.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. You are very welcome at the moment.
I'm doing pretty well. So a record for the transaction is created by the Bitcoin network, and it's broadcast out to all the nodes on the network. Every node on the network then checks the transaction and validates it. Okay? Periodically, a predefined number of validated transactions are grouped together into a block. So there's the first half of the term coming into use, block.
Block.
Block. What comes next? Now, in order for the information contained within these blocks to be secure, the blocks themselves must be encrypted. Okay. And this is done using cryptography. Yeah, the science of secrecy. This idea of encrypting data that we don't want other people to be able to see, we want to keep secret. Now, we're going to come back to the cryptographic element of Bitcoin later on, because it gets, as you can imagine, it gets pretty complex, and there's a lot to unpack there. But just, yeah, for the moment, it's enough to know that that there is cryptography going on here, that the data that a blockchain holds is being secured.
Protected.
Exactly, is being protected. So by encrypting the blocks, the information in them is kept secure from those who don't have the key, basically those outside the network. And the encrypted blocks are then joined together one after another in a sequential chain to form a...
chain. Blockchain.
Exactly. A chain of blocks. A blockchain. Yeah. So in order for this encryption and linking of blocks to be done, the network has to agree that all the transactions are valid and the ledger can be updated. And this is known as consensus. Now, this is another term. Now, this is all related to the cryptographic element of it. Again, it's very involved. So this is something, again, that we're going to tackle in a later episode when we get really technical.
Nice.
So consensus is reached when a majority of the nodes, 51% or more, agree that everything is as it should be and the blockchain can be updated with the latest batch of transactions. So the encryption of the blocks means that not only can everyone using the network be confident that the transaction data hasn't been interfered with, but also that the ledger itself is immutable. Here's another term that we hear a lot when we talk about blockchains, immutable. It means it can't be altered.
There's no third party.
Yeah.
So there's no government leaning on someone saying, cool, this transaction isn't happening anymore.
Exactly. Exactly.
So like PayPal and the US government and WikiLeaks, this could never happen, hence why WikiLeaks had.
Exactly, yeah.
Crypto.
Yeah, because the whole point of the blockchain is that it removes the need for any sort of third party. And this was the really tough nut to crack. How do you create a network that kind of polices itself in a way that doesn't need someone to oversee it and make sure that everyone's being kept honest? This was the huge problem. So this idea of a blockchain being immutable, once something is in the record, once a transaction is committed to the blockchain and has been encoded in a block and that block has been added to the chain, there is no way of going back and altering those records. So this is why sometimes people refer to it as something like a truth machine. Basically, something that can be absolutely relied upon. Yeah, because there's no way, we have no way of, well, without trusting
You'd have to compromise a lot of nodes.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is something, yeah, we're going to get onto this in a moment, because that is, theoretically, it is possible if you gain control of enough nodes. But as we'll see in a moment, there are ways around that as well. There are ways to keep the network honest, even if that were to happen. So because of this encryption, the information contained in the blocks, it can't be changed retroactively. No one can go back and fiddle with
it. Rewrite the books. Cook the books.
Cook the books, exactly. But centralized databases, of course, don't have this level of security. Although most breaches of centralized databases, the ones like we talked about earlier, although the aim really there is to get hold of the data and sell it, there's also nothing stopping a particularly malicious hacker from altering the data instead of perhaps selling it. And you can imagine how much chaos that would cause if someone was able to, let's say, break into the central database of the Bank of England, say, and go and rearrange and tamper with all the data, and, you know, maybe wipe the accounts of certain account holders, transfer money to others. It would cause absolute chaos. So this is something that the blockchain seeks to avoid. It's just simply impossible to go back and alter it. Okay, so and although this is unlikely to happen, although it is unlikely that someone would go to all the trouble of hacking a huge centralized database and then altering everything in it, we have to remember that humans are corruptible. There are always humans in the chain of command when you have these centralized structures. So even though it might not be in the best interest of a bank or perhaps a card company to interfere with customer data themselves even, we can't be sure that a human somewhere in the process couldn't be persuaded to do that. Or they could be forced to do that. They could be blackmailed to do that. It doesn't necessarily have to be, they don't necessarily have to be doing it for personal financial gain.
Yeah.
They could be leaned on. So again, it just highlights the sensitivity, the vulnerability of these centralized databases and the chaos that can ensue. Now, what I've just given you there is a really, really simplified overview of what a blockchain is and how it works. So we're going to dig a little deeper down into the process in a minute. But I just want to touch really on two of the most important qualities that should be apparent by now. So the fact that it's decentralized.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's immutable. So these are two big weaknesses of centralized databases, of the traditional database style, that have been that are no longer worried about when we talk about a blockchain. There's no single point of failure. The information it carries can't be disputed. Now, let's say you were to dispute the transaction. Let's say you'd sent me a Bitcoin. The network had logged it. It had all gone through. If you were to dispute that, if you were to say, hang on, I never sent that. Something's wrong here. Then all we can do is go back and check the record, and we have our answer. It's clearly shown there. There's no way that I could have manipulated it to show that you'd sent me, unless I had access to your private key, which would be very unlikely. When I was researching this, a real life kind of example sprang up to me, and this is very, very simplified. But do you remember when we left university? So this is kind of early to mid noughties.
Yeah.
And we were all back home here in London. There was you and me, and there was a few others of us, people like Joe and Mark, our old school friends, and people like that. And I remember there was a period over a few years where we were all kind of working occasional jobs and things like that, trying to figure out what we wanted to do, mostly living back at home with our parents, all this sort of stuff. And sometimes we would have money and sometimes we didn't.
Yeah.
And so we were always, as I remember, we were always
in each other's pockets.
Yeah. Borrowing money off each other, lending money to each other. So there was absolutely no way of keeping track of it. And I used to kind of dream, because we'd always have these disputes about it. We'd meet up a few nights later. It'd be like, you got that 20 quid?
what, 20 quid?
This is the sort of example. I think it shows it quite well because, yeah, transactions are happening all the time. There's no way we can all remember that. It's very difficult to keep all these records up to date, especially if these transactions are happening peer-to-peer. Because obviously, if we were transferring money to each other through our bank accounts or cards or whatever, then our banks would have a record of it. But these were cash transactions, weren't they? These were grubby £20 notes being handed over in pubs late at night. And I just remember thinking, wow, that if only there was a way of keeping track of all this, of having a sort of godlike overview of it, and then I would be vindicated and I would get the hundreds of pounds that were due to me and everything would be fine. And in that way, I think I can be said to be the father of blockchain. I think that's a good point to just have a break and take stock.
Yeah, let's have a quick five.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Let's take a moment to think about how amazing this whole blockchain system is.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Sure.
Just a moment. Because, yeah, there's no one entity in charge. There's no centralization. There's no single point of failure. It's a completely decentralized network. It creates a record that can't be altered or disputed in any way. And the term we often use here is censorship resistant. It can't be tampered with. And it solves this double spend problem, which, as we've talked about quite a lot, is vital if you're going to use any sort of digital asset. You can't have people spending the same asset twice.
Yeah.
So this is something that these are all things that blockchain has managed to do. And this is why cryptocurrency is able to function. But here's a question for you. So let's say that someone wanted to attack a blockchain for some reason, and that would probably be financial gain. I mean, that is the obvious reason that springs to mind for attacking the Bitcoin blockchain, say.
Yeah.
To try and basically get more Bitcoins for yourself, to allocate, you know, either to double spend your Bitcoins or to get hold of other people's Bitcoins, to have Bitcoins wrongly transferred to you, any sort of financial gain like that. So you might ask then, Mike, what prevents someone from running multiple nodes and gaining more control of the network that way? A node is very easy to run. All you need basically is a computer that's running the Bitcoin software.
Yeah.
So if someone was able to control a majority of nodes on the network, they could have their...
A node at all.
That's actually quite good. I like that. If there was some node at all out there who could control the majority of the network, they could have their fraudulent transactions confirmed. And this would obviously corrupt the whole blockchain.
So people would need to control 51% of the nodes.
Yeah, well, technically speaking, 51% of the computing power, which is something that we're going to dig into probably next episode. But yeah, 51% of the network, if you like, in order to put these fraudulent transactions through. So this is something to bear in mind, because although this is very unlikely to happen, it is theoretically possible. It could theoretically be done that someone could commit enough computing power to control 51% of the network. Very, very difficult. This would have been easier in Bitcoin's early days, because now there are thousands of nodes on the network and there are thousands of other nodes committing the majority of the computing power, known as miners. In Bitcoin's early days, when there are only a handful of nodes on the network, then it would have been much, much easier for one entity, for one person, for one body or anything like that to take over the network and corrupt it. It's not so much of a problem now, even though it is theoretically possible.
Okay.
But this is something that Satoshi had to contend with in Bitcoin's early days, because it would kind of have strangled it at birth if this had been possible to do. Obviously, one way to get around this sort of thing, one way to ensure that a blockchain didn't have a majority of nodes taken over, a majority of nodes corrupting the network, would be to have a central authority keeping an eye on all the nodes and authorizing each one. But this would, of course, destroy the decentralized nature of the network. So we kind of get back to square one. So this is the issue that Satoshi Nakamoto managed to overcome with Bitcoin. So what he was able to do was to devise basically a system of incentives and punishments that would keep all the nodes on the network honest, and whilst at the same time, any that tried to corrupt the network, it basically made that process pointless. And this was all to avoid having to have that centralized authority in place, that one person at the top or in the middle.
The corruptible.
Yeah. So how was he able to make this work? Well, we're going to get mildly technical.
Mildly technical.
But I'll take you through it. A certain type of node creates these blocks on the blockchain, these batches of validated transactions, and then adds them to the chain.
Okay.
Now, these nodes are what are known as miners.
Okay.
Okay? And we hear about Bitcoin mining all the time. And
yes.
In the next episode, we're going to dig into what that is. But that is basically the creation, the process by which new Bitcoins are created. Miners are rewarded for doing this work. They are rewarded for assembling the blocks of transactions and adding them to the network. And they get rewarded in the coin native to the blockchain that we're on. So in this case, Bitcoin. So a Bitcoin miner gets rewarded for that, for maintaining the Bitcoin blockchain with, you guessed it, Bitcoins. Okay, and this is called a block reward. And again, this is something we'll touch on when we talk about mining. So these Bitcoin rewards are basically, the way they're distributed, very, very simply, is through a lottery-like system. That again is something that mining, that we'll explain when we talk about mining. But this reward provides the incentive for them to do the work, because as we'll see, they are having to commit computing power in order to do this, and they need to be rewarded for that. Otherwise, there's nothing in it for them. So what stops them from trying to earn more rewards by running multiple mining nodes, which could give them control of the network? Well, as I said, all these miners, they have to expend computing power in order to earn the chance to win this Bitcoin lottery. If you like, their lottery ticket is paid for in computing power. Okay.
So they do a little bit of work. They put in the effort, the time, the energy into processing these transactions. And as a reward, they get entered into a lottery. And then every X amount of minutes, they get they earn some Bitcoin.
Yes, exactly. It is literally a case of minutes. Roughly, it's every 10 minutes on Bitcoin. So roughly every 10 minutes on the Bitcoin network, a new block is added to the blockchain and a block reward is paid out. And that at the moment is 6.25 Bitcoins. Which if you do the maths, it actually used to be a lot more. In Bitcoin's early days, it was 50 Bitcoins. Yeah, which was worth peanuts then. I mean, in Bitcoin's very early days, it was worth absolutely nothing. But now it would obviously be worth millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And that block reward has halved over time. And again, this is something I'll talk about when we talk about mining.
Sure.
So there is an incentive for the miners to do this work. And yeah, as you say, they're committing, it's energy really they're committing. They're running their computers, they're using this computing power. And this system is known as proof of work. Okay? So proof of work is something that was actually developed a long time before Satoshi invented Bitcoin. Now, there were a number of other experiments back in the 90s and early 2000s. People have been trying to create a peer-to-peer digital cash for quite a long time. And again, this is something we'll touch on in another episode, but there were things like Hashcash and BitGold and various other projects that tried to do this, but none of them could quite
nail it.
Yeah, none of them could quite nail it. But a big component of this, now proof of work was actually invented by, was actually first used by a British cryptographer called Adam Back. He came up with the idea that this was the way in which computers could be incentivized
and rewarded for doing the grit.
Yeah, doing the legwork. Yeah. So what Satoshi managed to do was pull together a number of features from previous experiments at creating a peer-to-peer digital cash and actually devise a system that worked. So this proof of work, it actually plays a role in keeping the network secure as well. And again, that's something that we come back to with mining, and it's related to the encryption part of it that we talked about earlier. But proof of work eats a lot of computing power. And that obviously has to be paid for. You can't run a computer. You can't have a computer doing all sorts of calculations running 24/7 and not pay for it. Your energy bill will go through the roof. And this is something that we see because this system has only expanded as Bitcoin has got bigger. And this is one of the reasons that so many people have flagged up the fact that Bitcoin eats so much electricity, because there are so many computers, there are so many miners using this proof of work system.
But is that not the same for any ledger? So for how banks store all that information and the amount of different parties involved in the fiat sort of digital currency system, is it not similar, or is it more?
Well, the nature of proof of work is that every single miner has to do it, but only one gets the reward. So 99.9% of the miners are actually doing this heavy computer work with no reward. It's kind of ultimately pointless because only one miner actually wins it.
There can be only one.
There can be only one, exactly. But yes, it is true that with centralized databases and with things like Visa's payment network and all this sort of stuff, they do use a lot of electricity. And data has to be stored on big servers, and these servers have to be kept cool. They're kept running. So yeah, I think it's fair to say that centralized data storage is a
big user. Also a big hog of the old energy.
Yeah, yeah. But proof of work involves a computer running millions, billions even, billions and sometimes trillions of calculations. So the actual computing work done is much, much heavier, is a much heavier load than it would be just kind of running a server with data on. But it's a good point, yeah, because it's something to push back on when people say, oh, well, Bitcoin is a waste of electricity. It just, because it sums up the fact that actually anything we do, if we're storing data, if we're running computers, if we're using YouTube or any of these systems, that involves the use of energy. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, as we saw last time with banking infrastructure.
Yes.
And payment infrastructure and things like this. There's tons of stuff running behind the scene. This all needs to be powered. This all needs to be protected.
And paid for.
And paid for. Yeah. And as we saw, that we pay for that. We, the consumer, foot the bill for that. So let's move on then. If a miner wants to gain control of the network, what they'll have to do is commit a lot of computing power and therefore money in order to do so. And this expense will be such that it will almost certainly cancel out any financial gain the miner would get from corrupting the network. Do you see? Because they'd have had to use so much computing power in order to be able to gain 51% of control that there's no way that what they earned from doing that would probably cover their costs. But it gets worse for any sort of would-be fraudulent miner, because even if they were able to force through their fraudulent transactions, the rest of the network would notice what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
And this would have the corresponding effect of then destroying the integrity of the network, and that in turn would wipe out the value of the fraudulent miner's coins. Because if Bitcoin is corrupted, if one miner manages to gain control and corrupt the Bitcoin network,
yeah,
then everyone loses confidence in it.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin becomes worthless. So all the Bitcoins that this miner was either seeking to earn or maybe had earned before and was holding would themselves become worthless.
It's like cutting off your nose to spite your own face, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly.
Only with money.
Only with money, yeah, exactly. It's an ingenious system of kind of, I guess, carrot and stick.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's self-regulation.
Yeah.
Checks and balances.
Yeah. These are all built into the system, and the system maintains itself. But the key thing, as we've seen, is that there is no one who either can step in or would be needed to step in if something were to go wrong. The network polices itself. And this is what's so clever about what he achieved. He managed to get all these kind of plates spinning, if you like. Everything about the network, about the Bitcoin network, kind of supports it. If you try and do something wrong, if you try and fool the network in any way, then there are incentives and punishments that will make it not worth it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It polices itself. So, the fraudulent miners' ill-gotten bitcoins would be worthless. What would they have gained from what they were trying to do?
The only thing I could think of is maybe an anarchist trying to do something like that. Someone who just wants to see the world burn.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, that's an interesting point. And, I mean, there is another similar threat that you could argue. What if a government wanted to do it?
Ooh.
Because really...
Someone threatened by this.
Yeah.
And another PayPal situation.
Well, this has been talked about before. The idea that maybe, okay, there's no real financial incentive to attack the Bitcoin network. No one could be able to commit that sort of computing power. No one would have the money. No one would have good reason to do it. But what if someone, as you say, just kind of wanted to destroy the network for other reasons, they weren't looking for financial gain at all. And yeah, that could be, I guess, someone who, yeah, just wanted to cause chaos, or more likely, a government who wanted to bring the network down. And there are only really two governments who could possibly do this. The US government or the Chinese government could theoretically do this. But China has made it a lot more difficult, because China, for quite a long time, even though China's government has kind of banned Bitcoin on many, many occasions or tried to or made it very difficult for Chinese citizens to hold Bitcoin, for a long time, a lot of Bitcoin miners were based in China. But as part of China's crackdown on mining, they have now been pushed out of the country. And the problem with having so many Bitcoin miners in China meant that the mining power was being centralized. It was being concentrated in one place. And this was something that a lot of people were worried about. What if the Chinese government, which, let's face it, could do something authoritarian like this if it wanted to. I mean, the Chinese government kind of doesn't really have anyone stopping it.
Or what happened to those miners?
Well, those miners were, because they were forced out of China, they've gone elsewhere, and a lot of them have gone to the United States. Basically, they've gone where energy is cheaper. So a few have moved into kind of Central Asia, where there is a lot of cheaper energy. But a lot have now gone to the United States. In fact, I think it's almost the case that the mining power that was in China has now shifted almost wholesale over to the US, where there's states like Texas are a lot more accommodating for crypto miners. And they also use a lot more renewable energy. This was the problem. This was another problem in that a lot of these miners were using Chinese coal power.
Yeah.
And this is obviously, there's no way of slicing this. You know, that is bad for the environment. However much of a Bitcoin believer you are, however much you support it and want Bitcoin to thrive, if Bitcoin mining is being done through the burning of coal, that is bad. But if it's being done through clean, renewable, safer energy,
yeah,
then that's much better. So you could argue that perhaps the focus has shifted now. China, I don't think, would be able to do it now that it doesn't have direct control over so many miners. You could argue the US government would want to do it, but it's hard to see really. I mean, it would have to commit so much money, and it would be very difficult to do quietly.
Mm.
That again, and I think this is something that Bitcoin's managed to do over the 13 years of its existence. It's managed to grow so big, and there are so many miners and also other nodes just running the software all across the world, that it's almost impossible for one single country to take it over, even if a lot of miners are concentrated in that country like they are in the United States. And again, it's this kind of system of rewards and incentives. What would the US government really gain from shutting Bitcoin down at this point or corrupting the network?
Yeah.
Especially as so many US citizens are heavily invested in Bitcoin. Yeah. All it would really do is cause an enormous outcry.
Yeah. It's a PR disaster.
It would be a PR disaster. Very difficult, I think, now to imagine a situation in which any government would want to go to all that effort.
Yeah.
What would be the point? What would be the reward?
Yeah.
Just destabilizing.
I suppose it's just if they feel that the dollar is at threat.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, the dollar hegemony throughout the world, the dollar as a sort of world's de facto reserve currency, is being threatened by crypto, being threatened by Bitcoin. And obviously we have countries like El Salvador now which have adopted Bitcoin as legal tender. And this is not something that's gone down particularly well with the US government. So I don't know, perhaps if more countries were to start adopting Bitcoin, if we were to start seeing it spread maybe through...
It could be a victim of its own success.
It could be.
But then surely would the miners not just move to a different country? And then?
Well, yeah. And this is, again, this is something we're seeing. Like, because El Salvador has adopted Bitcoin as a legal tender, a lot of miners have now moved there. And by this point, I think, Mike, I hope you agree, we have a very simple overview of how a blockchain like Bitcoin's works.
Yeah.
A decentralized network of nodes and miners that are incentivized to behave in an honest fashion. If they didn't, they'd gain nothing from being a part of the network. And if any miner was to step out of line, the penalties for doing so would just not be worth the effort that they expended in trying to do that. So the network is designed to keep itself honest. So there are quite a few technical matters that we've maybe talked about that have maybe come up in conversation, but we haven't yet addressed. So before we sign off, I just want to give people a flavor of what we're going to talk about in the next episode.
Sure.
So we haven't looked at how these blocks are encrypted. Do you remember early on I said, yeah. We need to talk about that. We also need to talk about how they get added to the blockchain.
That process.
Yeah, it's not as simple as I made out. Now, we've talked a lot about mining, but what exactly is mining? We've touched on it, but we haven't gone into detail. And so we are going to answer these questions and a lot more in the next episode.
Let's get technical.
Let's get technical. Next week. We're going to get really, technical in the next episode. Are you ready for that?
Sure.
Yeah? It's going to be fun.
Let's get the coffees in.
Thanks for sticking with us, everyone. You've got lots more very technical talk to look forward to in the next episode.
You knowed it.
Thanks, Mike. This has been fun.
Cool. Take care, guy.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.